This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we spend the hour on a few different topics. Coming up, at a time when local newspapers seem to be dying out, a southeastern Indiana publisher is launching two new papers. And tourism in Indiana has taken a big hit from the pandemic, so the industry is making a safety promise to consumers as long as they vow to do their part. And Carmel, Indiana is trying out wastewater testing to determine future coronavirus outbreaks. But the researchers who developed the technique say more municipalities could easily adopt the practice. But first, we'll begin the way we always do with a recap of the state's biggest headlines with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
It's going okay. But yesterday was a bad day for Indiana in the coronavirus pandemic. What do we know?
Yeah. So as of noon today, 2,821 people had died from COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. There are more than 72,000 confirmed cases and more than 812,000 Hoosiers who have been tested so far. So comparing that to last week, we had 2,765 people who had died from COVID. But last week, we were only at 66,000 confirmed cases. And that's because new cases have continued to climb fairly dramatically. Today, in fact, was a new record-setting day of COVID-19 cases. 1,253 new cases were reported today. Yesterday was 1,039 cases were reported, which had broken a previous record of 997 cases from the end of July. And so something to really keep in mind with all of these numbers is that these spikes are far higher than what we saw back in April. The record that the end of July broke from April was on April 26th, and that was 946. And that was a very – that seemed like an extreme anomaly when just looking at the data. But as we're looking at that chart on coronavirus.in.gov, as you're seeing the daily positive cases, as you're seeing the seven-day moving average, it's very clear that everything still is continuing to trend upwards.
I mean, what – when we look at this – Is it a result of more testing, or is that ratio just, I mean, the ratio is looking just as bad as these numbers do, it seems like?
Yeah, there's one of the things that the State Department of Health really focuses on is 7-day positivity trends. Mm. So it is the percentage of people that are being tested that are testing positive. So total overall from the beginning of everything, our total positivity rate was 8.8%, which is higher than what we're currently at because we did previously focus hyper-focus, in fact, on people that were suspected to have COVID, people who were in groups that would suffer the most if they were positive and did not, you know, seek treatment early. So that's the reason that's higher. Our current 7-day positivity rate is 7.5%. A shout out that I would like to do is WIBC's Eric Berman does a really incredible job of kind of explaining a lot of what these positivity trends mean. Our current percentage at 7.5 is elevated from what we've previously seen. So there is definitely cause for concern.
And I believe that the 7-day average, we did a show, it was just yesterday on an update on the pandemic. And I think as of yesterday, our guests were reporting a 7.4. I know a 0.1 increase doesn't seem like much, but it is alarming when we look at the 5% threshold that's been thrown out there for walking back restrictions or closing down schools that some have suggested. Obviously, we are not doing that. We've given local schools districts autonomy on their decision making. So, well, thanks for the update on the numbers. Speaking of schools, what do we know about privacy concerns on contact tracing?
Yeah. So, you know, as Indiana schools are reopening for the new academic year, some have been reporting cases of COVID-19 among staff or students. The state's top school official says efforts to find people who've been potentially exposed to the coronavirus is proving difficult. Indiana is investing millions of dollars in contact tracing, and health experts say it can help isolate and reduce the spread of coronavirus. But schools are reporting challenges with that particular process, namely parents who are skeptical of sharing information about their children with strangers over the phone, because that's what you do. Like, you get a mysterious phone call from somebody and they're like, hey, I need to know information about your child so that I can tell you that they might have been exposed to literally a pandemic virus. Mm-hmm. More than 30 schools have chosen to begin the school year virtually, while others have delayed the start of the school year. And State Health Commissioner Chris Box emphasized this week that people should stay home if they have symptoms, and that parents should also keep their children home if they are waiting for COVID-19 test results.
I can only imagine the workload that these contact tracer the people that make the phone calls, what they're working under. They've got to be busy. Do we know anything about the content of these phone calls? I mean, do they identify themselves appropriately to where that might instill confidence in the people that they're trying to contact?
Yeah, there's something a little fuzzy there. McCormick, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, talked about this yesterday on her webinar, or her weekly webinar. And she said, you know, even as contractors or as contact tracers are identifying themselves, families are really unsure of how much information they can safely relay to them. And so what she's seen a lot of or heard a lot of from other folks across the state is people getting this phone call, calling the school to see if it was legit, and then also still being worried about like the content of that call, like how much information they should be giving up.
Mm. What do we know about the state school helpline that was launched?
Yeah. So Wednesday, the Indiana State Department of Health announced it was going to launch a hotline for school administrators to call with questions about COVID-19. State Health Commissioner Chris Box says the hotline is one of a number of tools the state is using to help schools reopen, including a school nurse coordinator who's been doing weekly webinars. Many school districts around the state have already reopened. Box said the state is relying in part on the, quote, personal responsibility of parents to not send their kids to school if they're showing symptoms. And of course, this is all in a greater context that the Holcomb administration has resisted laying out specific metrics at which schools should shut down or opt not to reopen to in-person instruction. Box said those are local decisions that should take into account several factors, including the number of positive cases and tests being performed on their counties, which all comes back to county health officials and school officials, you know, really interpreting the data that they have at their availability and coming to a decision that is both respectful of, you know, the health of kids and families and also respectful of the real economic burdens that not having schools open would cause.
It seems like that balance is really being attempted. That balance of authority and autonomy, and it's just interesting to see the dynamics of all of that.
As I'm fond of saying, it's all kind of bad. Like, there's not a good decision to make here.
No. So the eviction moratorium ends next week.
Next week, yeah, August 14th. Mm. Basically, what was communicated by Governor Holcomb in not so many words was that he was not super interested in extending the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures across the state. So to anticipate a flood of evictions, the state is launching a settlement arbitration tool for Hoosier landlords and renters. The governor's general counsel, Joe Herons, said the goal of the arbitration program, which will be free of charge to renters and landlords, is to settle eviction lawsuits and prevent massive backlogs in the courts. More than 24,000 Hoosiers have already applied for rental assistance through the state's through a $25 million state program. The Holcomb administration announced Wednesday it is adding $15 million more dollars to that program. Which I think their original guess for how many folks they would be able to help with that money was 12,000, and they've had more than 24,000 apply. That all being said, that assistance is not meant to provide enough money to cover a single month's rent, and the state urges people to talk to their landlords and work out a payment plan rather than relying on that kind of state funding.
How long has the moratorium been in effect? Do we know?
You know, I was trying to figure that out with
Months. I mean, since almost since the onset of the pandemic, I believe.
Yes. And it's been extended. So it was part of the stay at home orders in general. And then it was extended twice, I believe.
So let's look at peer support for addiction and mental illness here in Indiana.
Yeah. So Indiana is getting more people with mental health and substance use disorders connected with peer supports, people who are trained professionals who have personal experience with those challenges. Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition Director Brandon George said the state isn't just dealing with a COVID-19 pandemic. It's also still struggling with an overdose and addiction epidemic. And he said COVID-19 has exacerbated that problem. The peer support program, which was announced, or I'm sorry, the expansion was announced Thursday. And so it's going to send at least 40 full and part-time professionals to recovery groups all across the state in order to kind of shore up existing resources for folks.
And we got the news this week that despite Roger Penske's assertion since almost the beginning of the pandemic that we would have fans at the Indy 500, what do we know now?
Not going to have fans.
Not going to happen.
Yeah. The Indy 500 will run without people in the stands this year. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway announced that decision Tuesday, of course, reversing those previous plans to maintain some attendance during the coronavirus pandemic. They, of course, cited, you know, the rising COVID-19 cases trends. IMS officials said that even allowing only 25% of fans, which is what they had talked about the previous week, with the safety precautions that they already had in place, just simply wasn't going to be the right thing to do. Last month, organizers released a comprehensive health plan for race attendees, which included temperature checks and required face masks and hand sanitizers. And while no fans may attend the August 23rd race, IMS says it does plan to have fans back for 2021.
She's as busy as ever, and she makes it look easy. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. She's also our school nurse. Lauren, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the new owners of Whitewater Publishing in southeastern Indiana have revitalized their existing newspapers and are launching two new papers in nearby communities. How do they plan to do it? That's next. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. All across the country, local newspapers are struggling. Many are shells of what they once were. Without the ability to pay local reporters, the content of local papers is often national news taken from the AP wire, which you can get anywhere. And forget about new papers cropping up. Once a community loses its newspaper, it's often for good. That is, unless you live in southeastern Indiana, where not only has one local publisher seen a revitalization of its local coverage and community engagement, but they're launching two new papers in nearby communities. Joining me now is Cassie Garrett. She's content and newsroom team leader for Whitewater Publications based in Brookville, Indiana. Cassie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We also have Brian Noah, Whitewater Publications publisher and managing editor. Brian, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having both of us on today.
So, Brian, what are the papers you currently publish?
Well, currently we publish the Brookville American, the Brookville Democrat, and then we have two, and those are both in Franklin County, and then we have two newspapers in Union County as well, which is the Liberty Herald and the Union County Review.
And how long have those papers been around?
Well, the Brookville American is kind of our baby. It's been printed consecutively since 1833. And then the Democrat was close behind at 1838. We can actually trace the Brookville papers back to 1815, but it was kind of spotty between 1815, 1819. And then there were some issues in 1832 and 33, where at the tail end of 33, they started printing again, and we haven't stopped.
I mean, does that give you a claim to being, I don't know, one of the oldest papers in Indiana by any stretch?
Matt, I think everybody likes to make that claim. It seems like when newspapers go out, the first part of the article is this was the oldest paper in Indiana, and now it's no longer being printed. And the last couple that I saw were like in 1840 and in 1845. So really, I do believe that we are the oldest consecutively printed paper in the state of Indiana.
You're part owner of Whitewater Publications. When did you buy into the group?
So that was that came about in June of 19. We put the funds together to purchase from the owners that had purchased the newspapers in 1975. You know, in 75, there were four owners, and of that group, there were three of them left, and that's the group that we purchased from.
What were the papers like when you bought into the company? I mean, was there good coverage? Was there enough subscribers?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, when we bought in, my partner and I, Mick Wills and Jenny Wills, and obviously my wife, the four of us, you know, we really knew what we wanted to do, which was purchase the paper, keep the paper local, give it back to the community, kind of be stewards of the paper, and leave it better than what we found it. You know, as far as financials, we looked them over, and we knew that the papers were struggling, you know, probably 3 to 6 months from either laying off their tenured employees or closing down the Liberty papers. They'd already shut down the Liberty office. You know, it wasn't good, but we knew that going in. You know, our intent wasn't to get rich off of these papers. It was, you know, it really was just to make sure that that a chain didn't come in and drop AP News, you know, in the whole paper and take the community out. So yeah, we were close to extinction, you know, a year ago in June when we purchased.
I mean, Cassie, it's easy for a local media company to exchange ownership and then say they're going to do these things, but it's another thing to actually make those kinds of improvements. I mean, I've worked for local media before, and at the end of the day, I mean, you got a product to put out and a small staff to do it oftentimes, and sometimes just easier to follow the old template. How have these new measures been put into practice?
So really, it goes back to kind of what Brian was saying. You know, when we first initially came in and we said, you know, they had the vision of being stewards of the community and giving this back. And then when I came into it, you know, it was a passion for me. So that was what was fueling it for me. And I believed in it initially. But going into the communities, kind of like what you just said, you know, how were we really going to make this make sense? The day that I heard the Herald Tribune had merged, as well as the Rushville Republican, I'll never forget, I was sitting in my car and I read the articles like two or three times each. And I grew up, you know, reading the Herald Tribune. And if one of our editors or sports editors missed something, then you knew Debbie Blank was going to cover it. So I just grew up with that. And to see that they were closed, I couldn't believe it. And so I called Brian and I just told him about it. And I said, you know, it's not just Batesville, it's Rushville too. And he says, okay. And he, and that was the end of the conversation. So I waited and I just kind of dropped seeds. And then I approached him again and just said, what do you think about going into these communities? And he said, you know, how does it make sense? He literally said almost exactly what you said to me, you know, how are we going to make it happen? You know, I believe in the community part, but how can we really do this when we were struggling ourselves very recently? So I wasn't 100% sure. I said, just give me some time. Let me look into it. Let me see if I can get the community involvement I think we can get, and we'll go from there. So that's when I was just blown away. You know, my passion drew me into that. But once I got into the communities and, you know, I was kind of on a quest to see if they even wanted this, you know, I'm like, is this really what what the community still want, or are they good with social media? Are they good with Facebook, you know, in the internet? So we went in there and the answer was just a resounding yes. And then it was immediately followed with how can we make it happen? And being just welcomed into those communities like that, and telling them, you know, we want to give you the community paperback, and they're just completely 100% in. And I started getting phone calls and emails from just different community members and saying, do you need a contributor? Do you need a historian? I literally, John Wilson in Rushville just phoned me today and said, absolutely, as we work towards our bicentennial, I would love to put a story in about Rushville's history every week. And when you get that kind of response, I realized that when it's done right, the newspaper kind of becomes the heartbeat of your community. You know, yeah, you report news and you inform on local officials and you talk about candidates that are coming up to be elected, but you also celebrate five generations of family members. You announce the birth of your grandson because that's still special to you and you want everybody to see it that still gets that newspaper. My daughters always go to the honor roll to go cut themselves out. And I always tease them and say, you guys aren't in there this week. And they're like, yeah, right. Yes, we are. You know, that's the special part. And the way you get that and the way you make that feasible is by, like I said, giving it back to the community. We have more support just from community members that are just stepping up and saying, what can we do to make this happen? We want our newspapers back.
We're talking with Cassie Garrett. She's content and newsroom leader for Whitewater Publications based in Brookville, Indiana. We also have Brian Noah, their publisher and managing editor with us. Brian, I think understandably so, it sounds like you had reservations. Can you kind of expand on that and kind of the thought process that brought you to eventually to the decision to start these new papers up?
Yes, absolutely. The, you know, the initial conversation was just as Cassie said, it was kind of short. And, you know, I was kind of taken by the whole conversation that Batesville and Rushville were done and that they were going to Greensburg. And, you know, my initial thought, which I didn't share with Cassie, was, you know, my first thought was Batesville because part of Batesville's in Franklin County. Batesville, we go into Oldenburg in the school there and cover the school events, and Oldenburg kind of touches up against Batesville. So I'm very familiar with that community. And as she said, she planted seeds. And the interesting part was I think she knew that I would be in on Batesville. And so she went to Rushville first. And I tell you, I can't wait to meet some of these people that she's met in Rushville because it's gone exactly as she said, which is they've all jumped in and said, what can we do to help? But to be specific about your question, we wrote welcome letters, right? You know, between myself and Cassie and the rest of the owners, we just kind of batted some ideas back and forth on, you know, what's our welcome going to be to Batesville? What's our welcome going to be to Rushville? And the night that I sat down to write those letters and really get into it, that was the night that was just like, I see this completely. Because, you know, without us, without a community newspaper, who's going to tell, you know, who's going to tell the story of who scored the touchdowns in the football game? You know, who's going to take the photos that get hung on your grandma's fridge? Just as, you know, just as Cassie was saying about her kids cutting out the honor roll. That's what we are there for. That's what a community newspaper is for. And it all really just clicked with me and the excitement, you know, from the people that I had met with in Batesville and the people that she had met with in Rushville just, you know, just brought it all together for me.
But and I understand why it was Cassie's idea. She's on the content side. I'm on the content side here at the radio
right.
station and with every other job that I've had. But you're on the money side. How are you going to make that work?
Well, that's a great question. The money side for us, you know, like I said, we didn't get into this to be, you know, to make a lot of money, to be rich. It was more about the community. And the shot in the arm that we got was my partners, Mick and Jenny Wills. They looked into something right before we started, which was called the Opportunity Zone Fund. And that's a federal program that really Jenny spearheaded because I guess she really just likes to dig into paperwork. But my goodness, she jumped in head first. I believe Mick and Jenny were the first ones in Indiana, may have even been the first ones in the country to use the Opportunity Zone and actually see projects completed with the Opportunity Zone. But what that is let's say you sell a business, which they did, which Mick and his family sold their business. And the Opportunity Zone provides you kind of a tax shelter or capital gains shelter, you know, if you invest in another business. And that's exactly what they did. Where the Opportunity Zone comes in, and some of the rules of that and how we benefited was their portion, Mick and Jenny's portion of purchasing the newspaper with the Opportunity Zone funds, then have to be doubled and put into the newspaper to give them that tax break. So as an example, you know, if they paid $100,000 for their portion of the newspaper, then they had to take $100,000 and put that in to the newspaper within the first 30 months for repairs, you know, building repairs, equipment upgrades, you know, payroll, different things like that, you know, whatever it took to give the business a shot in the arm. And that's exactly what we got with the Opportunity Zone fund. So we had that to give us our boost. We are headed towards stable footing and what I would call stable ground now, because, you know, we've taken the philosophy, if you do the right thing, all this works out. And we've seen that, you know, kind of come to fruition in Brookville and in Liberty. You know, even though we're not done with Brookville, we want to expand more, and Liberty's kind of our next project after we get these two papers launched. But it's on stable ground, and we knew that we could do this just with the formula that Cassie has, you know, Cassie's kind of put together. And it's, whether you call it a formula or an anti-formula, because, you know, we've looked at other papers that have gone out, again, just as you said, that have national content that you can get anywhere. She's put together a formula of community news, and, you know, what goes on page one, what goes on two, you know, where do the jumps go, where, you know, what crowd are we going to appeal to, what age group, and that's kind of right where we are, and how we knew that we could get into Batesville and how we could get into Rushville and build this excitement.
Cassie, this was your idea. I mean, are you about to get a whole lot busier?
You know, I feel like things are about to slow down once we just
really?
Get past. Yeah, I think once we get past that initial open date and we kind of have all of those ducks lined up a little bit more, they're all in the pool right now, but they're just kind of floating around doing their thing. So once we get all that straightened out, I think it's going to be a well-oiled machine. We've already started to plan kind of for what that next phase looks like too. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Brian and I both, you know, I'm from Franklin County, but I was telling the guys in Rushville that I have such fond memories of Rushville because we used to drive through there at least once a month to go to my grandma's house, who's in Northern Indiana. And there's these little people painted on the buildings in Rushville on the top floor on one of the old buildings. And I couldn't wait to see it. And I always hated if we went by at night because I couldn't see them. And so you have these fond memories because when you're in rural Indiana, you travel outside of your county. But so I can go up there and I can definitely help write and I will cover their meetings and get to know the people and completely embrace that as one of my, you know, heartfelt communities. But at the end of the day, we want people that live in Rushville and have grown up in Rushville or, you know, have started their family in Rushville now, whatever that looks like, we want them to be a part of the newspaper because they're going to be the ones that are truly going to steward that Rushville information like only someone from Rushville that has that connection will do. So we've already started to kind of put those people in place. And again, as Brian said, it's kind of when you are doing the right thing and you're working towards something that people are interested in, it works out. So we've had several people reach out to us and just say, hey, if you need someone to write when that time comes, let's do that. And as Brian, you know, mentioned, you talked a little bit too about how can you financially do this, but, you know, advertising is a big part of that. And that goes back to kind of the same thing we just talked about with the newspaper, but just reestablishing those relationships. how can we really help our advertisers in a local community get the word out? It's not by just running the same ad every week. It's by finding out, what are they doing for COVID? How can we help them continue to get dollars in their businesses to stay afloat and to keep going? So I think when we take that approach as well with advertising, we're going to see that we'll do good for us as well.
And so when are you launching the Rushville Recorder and the Batesville Leader?
We launch August 12th.
Wow. Okay. Next week.
Yeah.
And you're feeling good. You're ready.
Yeah, we are. I'm excited. I'm like, we get Brookville and Franklin County to press yesterday, and then we do Union County today. And I had some really great stories from Union County I was super involved in, but I am ready to start on that paper. It's going to get some extra attention. So I'm excited.
We've been talking with the management at Whitewater Publications. They put out the Brookville Democrat, Brookville American, and the Liberty Herald newspapers. And soon they'll be launching the Batesville Leader and the Rushville Recorder. Brian Noes, publisher and managing editor. Brian, thanks for your time.
Matt, thank you. We appreciate you bringing this to light as far as the print world goes. And, I'm just excited to get started with our new ventures. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Appreciate it. Cassie Garrett is content and newsroom team leader there. Cassie, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on and just giving us a chance to talk to why we're so excited about being in our communities that we're already in and going into these new communities.
Up next, an official commitment to safety from Indiana tourism businesses amid the COVID-19 pandemic. What are Indiana hotels, restaurants, and tourism destinations promising to patrons so they'll come back? That's next. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The impact that the pandemic has had on travel and tourism can't be overstated. Concerns about the coronavirus have kept most people at home, and for good reason. So attractions, hotels, and restaurants in Indiana have come up with the Hoosier Hospitality Promise to ensure that guests can travel safely. Here to help us dig into it a little bit more are Patrick Tam, CEO of Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. Welcome, Patrick.
Hey, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having us.
And Elaine Beadle is CEO of Indiana Destination Development Corporation. Elaine, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
So, Elaine, can you just sum up the Hoosier Hospitality Promise for us? What is it?
Well, absolutely. It's a program that really is all about health and safety and helping us to open up the economy in a very safe way, keeping everyone free of the coronavirus as much as we can. So we've got vendors or companies. They could be restaurants, hotels. They could be entertainment venues, theaters, museums, everyone who would like to sign up and take the promise. And the promise that they're saying is that I will make sure that our establishment is meeting all the requirements, all the health and safety requirements to keep our employees as well as our guests healthy. And those might be the CDC requirements, the state and local health department requirements, as well as maybe their national association. So they're going to check every box, and they want their guests to know that they're going to have the place ready for them to come and visit. And so they can sign up at HoosierHospitalityPromise.com as a vendor willing to make that promise. And if they would choose to, they can actually offer a discount. Now, on the other side is all of us consumers, that we need to be willing to do our part. So we can make the Hoosier Hospitality Promise to wear a face mask when we should, social distance, to wash our hands, to stay home when we're sick, all of those things that we need to do to be good consumers. That way, if we have Hoosiers on the vendors being careful and the consumers being careful, we can open this up safely. And so if consumers go to the website, HoosierHospitalityPromise.com, and make the promise, they will entitle themselves to a Hoosier Hospitality Promise Pass, which will give them access to all of the discounts that any of the vendors will be offering. So it's hopefully, again, a motivation to get people out and to show responsibility on both sides.
Patrick, was it challenging to get most businesses that you represent on board for this?
Absolutely not. Great question, Matt, but absolutely not the case. So restaurants and hotels have always been inspected by local and state health department officials. We also have a whole host of sanitation, disinfection protocols well before coronavirus. Now, at the same time, now there's additional things, additional measures that we're doing for CDC recommendations, Consumer for Food Protection recommendations as well, which really we came forward, approached the governor, Lieutenant Governor, and Elaine with this Hoosier Hospitality Promise concept. At that time, really for restaurants and hotels, selfishly. But now with the support of Lieutenant Governor Crouch, Governor Holcomb, as well as Elaine and the Indiana Destination Development Corporation, we are now able to take this to a much larger and more impactful group, which is all of tourism, all of attractions, museums, you name it. You know, science really doesn't show any geopolitical boundaries from one county to another. And Hoosiers throughout the entire state, this is a great opportunity for local business owners, local leaders to really visit HoosierHospitalityPromise.com, review those standards, accept them. Today, when you go into restaurants, Matt, oftentimes you're going to see the Hoosier Hospitality Promise documented, posted three, four times before you even get to that host stand. That's what we want people to see. It's creating that awareness. Some brands may also adopt it, redo some of those postings and so forth. But when people adopt the Hoosier Hospitality Promise, they're also making sure that themselves, their family, their loved ones also realize the role that they play right now. While we are trying to protect everyone that comes into our restaurant or a hotel or attraction, we also need guests to be doing the right things, just as Elaine just stated, to make sure everyone's safe.
Well, and let me just add to that very quickly that it has been expanded. And actually, we've had a dentist office, a law office, and several other businesses and retail shops who say, hey, we can do all of that, too. And we want to make the promise and make sure that we can tell everyone that we're ready to have guests in a very safe manner.
Elaine, can you give me a sense of the impact travel and tourism has on Indiana's economy?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think if we look at it from the GDP, the state of Indiana is about a $367 billion gross domestic product, GDP. And of that, about 10% or $37 billion can be attributed to activity within the leisure and travel related industry. And if we look at that $37 billion and break it down even farther, 85% or about $32 billion is actually from activity of our own Hoosiers, our residents within the state, going to our attractions, going to our restaurants, going to our theaters and museums, et cetera. And so, you know, right now with the COVID issue, we have a little bit of a psychological fear barrier that, you know, we're a little concerned going out. And of course, we want people to be careful and to be safe. But we feel like taking these steps and getting both the attractions and the vendors, et cetera, signing up and making the promise and the consumers doing the same thing, that we can create that environment that can hopefully make people comfortable.
We're talking about the Hoosier Hospitality Promise, an initiative to safely ramp up travel and tourism in Indiana. And we've been speaking with Patrick Tam, CEO of the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. Thank you, Patrick.
Hey, thank you, Matt.
And Elaine Beadle is CEO of Indiana Destination Development Corporation. Elaine, thanks for your time.
Oh, happy to give it anytime.
And now a look at another way a community can determine an outbreak of coronavirus. Wastewater. It's being tried out in just a few cities across the country, including one of the more highly populated suburbs of Indianapolis. Reporter Brock Turner from WFIU in Bloomington joins us now. Hi, Brock.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So when we last spoke, we were talking about contact tracing and the fact that local health officials could be and indeed want to be doing more to help with the statewide contact tracing efforts. This technique that we're talking about now could be a way to determine the larger rate of infection, right?
Yeah, and I definitely want to be clear from the top. Like, this wastewater testing does not replace traditional testing at, say, a drive-through testing site or other point-of-care tests that folks are sick would go to seek out. But really what this does is it really is a way for communities to get a a 30,000 foot view of the infection rates that are happening and the overall presence of COVID in their communities. So, you know, when we're talking about this technique, there are a lot of, you know, specifics that are going into it. But, you know, really what this does for municipalities is it gives them a significant lead time and a key data point that other types of testing just doesn't give them.
Can you explain how this works?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, wastewater treatment facilities across the country and across Indiana are no different. They're testing multiple samples a day in a lot of cases of the wastewater coming in, the wastewater they're returning back to whatever water source. In Carmel's case, it's the White River. So they're already conducting so many tests on this water to see what's in there, to make sure that the processes that they're putting the water through, you know, that you're, you know, running down the sink, and flushing out of the drain, down the drains, is returned, you know, cleaner or as clean that it, as it can be. So how this works is, there are two kind of different types of samples. One is automatically collected. Most of them are automatically collected from the wastewater sludge. And then other tests are conducted from other points of wastewater throughout the process. But sludge is probably the most common one. And that's basically just, you know, wastewater that's sort of been a lot of the solids have been diluted out and sifted out. And really, when you get that sludge, you're getting the sample and collecting it and then shipping it off to a lab.
I mean, we hear a lot about the importance of testing individuals for infection. We can't, I guess, really say that enough. But the information we could potentially get from this, I mean, it's a lot different. Can you explain why?
Yeah, so I like to think of a metaphor here, if I may, to think like the forest from the tree level.
Okay.
So the type of information we're getting with COVID testing from wastewater plants is really forest level information. It's sort of a 30,000 foot view if we're looking over top and saying like, okay, there's a problem here. It doesn't help us identify individuals that might be getting sick, and it doesn't really help us, you know, treat or contact trace with an individual, but it can help inform decisions that are happening at the community level. So for example, in Carmel and a lot of other communities across this country and even the world, policymakers are able to use this data along with public health, first responders, healthcare workers to determine what an outbreak might look like. So, you know, do we need to slow or halt reopening if levels of coronavirus in wastewater are increasing? Maybe we need to ramp up capacity at a local hospital or increase staffing or secure more PPE. And I think that's really the way that this is helpful, because there's not a lot of good data. And that's something that public health officials tell me all the time, that they're trying to get their hands on. They want more data. And this is something this is a piece of data that really helps officials be able to figure out what the best way to combat this outbreak and try and stem it is.
Well, how long does it take to get results from this kind of testing?
Yeah. And that's something that really varies. It depends on the lab. So the initial lab in Carmel said that the Carmel was using, called BioBot, it's based out of Boston, I believe. They said that they could get the samples back in just a few days, but they had some issues there in that lab, and that led to a backlog. And Carmel says that it took about 3 weeks for that first sample to come back. So it really varies significantly. Some cities, depending on the lab you're using, you could get it back in a couple of days, which is very helpful for policymakers, like we talked about earlier, who are trying to use that information. That's not a big delay at all. But if you're taking 2-3 weeks, you're dealing with old information, and it's very likely, you know, this is something that's always in flux. So it's pretty likely that the information has changed. So Carmel now is working with labs at Notre Dame and with NASA in hopes of getting those results back faster. But another thing that I should mention is it's not just about the time that it takes for the lab to get it. It's also about the labs being able to really precisely match these models with the community's wastewater system, because it's a very precise model that you have to really hone to figure out, okay, you know, what does an increase mean, and how do we act on that, on the increase that we're seeing. So the models are very cantankerous, and if you adjust them one way or the other, you're going to get very different results. Mm.
What are some of the biggest challenges to getting this done effectively?
Yeah, I would say there are two major challenges here. The first, as I mentioned earlier, lab capacity. Yeah. And then the second is really getting that is the predictive piece. So a lot of this research first came out of Yale University, who was working with the local wastewater plant there in New Haven. And they were able to really precisely narrow down their formula. But, you know, as I said earlier, it's really difficult to be able to get that narrowed down and make it useful for policymakers.
How new is this? Has anything like this been done before?
So in terms of testing wastewater, that process is not new at all. You know, municipalities, local governments have been testing their wastewater for decades. In terms of coronavirus testing, yeah, this is definitely a new thing. And, you know, the Yale study was really groundbreaking. I believe it was published in March or April of this year. And that was really the correlation, right? Because if you were to search any municipal water system and test it for various diseases, you would see so many diseases, so many bacteria in there. It was not really been able to be put to use until now. I will also say though that, you know, Europe, from a bit of the research that I've done and folks that I've talked to, Europe is really on the leading edge of this. They've been testing for a number of diseases in their wastewater and have used this as a pretty significant public health tool. And I think we're starting to see that with this pandemic and such a struggle for information, we're starting to see that really take off here. I think large wastewater facilities that are doing this. I've heard New York is considering doing this. Several in California are doing this. And then, of course, you're locally Carmel.
Yeah. And so Carmel is doing this. Would you say, though, that they're at a level where they're just trying it out, or is this a full-blown implementation happening in Carmel?
I would say it's probably somewhere in the middle. I think they're putting a lot of stock into this. They're really focusing on, you know, using this data because it is one of the only data sources that they have. That being said, lab capacity has sort of, you know, plagued them being able to implement this as much as I think officials up there would like. I know Mayor Brainard said that, you know, he would use this information to pause reopening, even if he felt like that it was warranted and that the data showed that was the case. So, you know, I think if capacity is able to ramp up and we're able to find ways to really hone these models, I think Carmel and a lot of other cities are going to be putting a lot of stock into this. That being said, is it as developed as folks would like now? No, but I think that's like so many things in this pandemic.
Carmel is a bit more of an upper middle class, sort of well-to-do suburb. Mm-hmm. How hard would this be for other local governments to implement? Is it expensive, or do we know anything else?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes this so intriguing for a lot of policymakers at the local level. It's relatively inexpensive. I know BioBot was pretty public in their charging. I believe initially samples cost about $300 to process. Now they're about $1,200 to process, which is pricey when you're talking about wastewater samples, but it's not a significant cost for a city government. I mean, you think about the cost of what one infection would be, not only for the individual, but in terms of the entire community and societal impact of that one infection. So I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's not cheap, but it is, it's an investment well worth the money.
Brock Turner is a reporter for WFIU in Bloomington. Brock, thanks.
Thanks a lot, man.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you'll always know what we're talking about. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for discussion and topic alerts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Wash your hands. This is All In.